Good morning. So we are in a series called Turning the Gem. And this is based off of a rabbinic phrase that says the scriptures are like a gem and that they have 70 faces to it. And as you turn the gem, it changes the way that you view it and the way that the light reflects off of it and refracts into it. And as you turn the gem, you see that something new about the gem. Every time you turn it and every time you see it, you see a new angle of it. The gem doesn't change, but your perspective of it does. And so for the summer, what we're going to do is we're going to turn the gem on the words and actions of Jesus. Many of the weeks are going to be on his miracles or on things he did or said that were unexpected. And part of that process is going to be we're going to give different people a chance to not only turn the gem and look at different sides of it, but also different people and different voices and different perspectives. So if you're part of the Harbor community, you know that I've been pretty consecutive for the last couple of months on doing it every week. And we're going to give different people a chance to turn the gem for the next couple of weeks. And so we're excited. Next week, actually, Amy Chaney, who does the host spot most weeks, is going to be speaking. And she was our youth director before this. And so she has spoke hundreds of times to teenagers. But this will be a new platform for her. So we're definitely excited about that. And then, so that's, you'll just kind of see different people for the next couple of weeks pop up and turn the gem for us. It's always specifically things that Jesus did or things that he said that were unexpected. So there's this word get into today that is that the word, it sounds to me kind of like a Batman villain, like the word does. And it's this word that it talks about their teeth and it's fluorine. It's also, I think, done a lot of damage for the cause of Jesus. And the word is this word named veneer. Like, doesn't that sound like a Batman villain? Like the veneer. And he like twists his mustache or whatever. But so veneer, it's this word that you use it to describe floor sometimes or use it to describe teeth. It's an attractive appearance that covers or disguises someone or something's true nature. The alternative is something that is the same thing all the way through. So like a veneer floor is like a small, thin layer of wood over like something that's some other material, and that's a veneer floor. Actually, when I was in college, I was playing a sport, and someone's forehead hit my tooth, and it bent my tooth in. And so I went to the dentist, and they're like, so I've got bad news and good news, which you don't want to hear from your dentist. He's like, your tooth is dead, and it's going to rot in your head, but what I can do is I can put a veneer on the front of it, and that way people won't know that that's happening. You're like, thank you? I don't really want an attractive, you know, it's better than nothing, right? Like, it's better to have, like, an attractive appearance that covers or disguises someone's or something's true nature. Like, that's, yeah, I'm glad that that's an option, but at the same time, it's not an option I'm super excited about, you know? So it's, and this the idea of a veneer when it comes to someone, the way that they view themselves or the way that they present themselves, it can be difficult and it could be damaging because if someone operates with a veneer, with like this thin layer on the outside, which is not true to who they actually are, which is different than who they are on the inside, and if you do that long enough, if you live and you operate and you have relationships with a veneer long enough, what happens is it's dangerous because you begin to believe the lie. You begin to believe the person you present to the world is the real and actual you. You begin to believe the veneer you is the real you. And so then you begin to think, oh, I'm good. I got this. I'm set. Like my veneer, it's good. But eventually what happens is the veneer cracks and the real you seeps out. And this is why the Bible talks about living with this authentic faith. And the thing is, like, I so often, when I talk to people who come to church for the first time in like 30 years or something, is they had a bad experience at church, or they had someone who was a church person who turned them off to things of faith, like for the rest of their life, they thought, I'm going to give church one more try. I haven't been to church in 30 years, but I'm going to give it one more try. I hear this story kind of regularly. And it's always, I knew someone, they said they were a church person, they said they aligned their life with Jesus, but then I saw who they really were. And I was like, I don't want that. Like, that doesn't look attractive at all. The thing is, like, if you begin to believe the veneer is the real you, like, this works against you actually becoming the person you present yourself as. Because in general, and not all the time, but in general, Jesus works and he operates and he molds and he shifts and he challenges us to the level at which we are honest. Like, if you're honest about yourself, if you're honest about your brokenness, then what Jesus does is he comes in and he shapes you and he molds you like to your core. If you're like, Jesus, I am broken, I need you, and he comes in to the core of you, I am broken, then he comes in and he shapes you and he molds you to your core. But if you put on a veneer of I'm good, I got this, then he has very little to work with. You don't realize your need for him. So this veneer that some people walk around with, it's so difficult. It works against you. And so what we're going to do is we're going to read a story today from Luke chapter 7, verse 38 through 46. And it's people who, one person in the story has this very obvious veneer, and the other person in the story is exactly who they say they are to their core. And we'll hopefully find ourselves in the story. By the way, if you don't own a Bible, I want you to walk out with one today. We have Bibles in the back shelf. That's our gift to you. If you don't own one, if you're new here, we leave with a Bible today. And so anyway, so if you have a Bible, turn to Luke chapter 7. If not, it'll be on the screen or on your phone, whatever. So in Luke 7, verse 36, it says this. One of the Pharisees asked Jesus to dinner with him. So Jesus went to his home and sat down to eat. When a certain immoral woman from that city heard he, Jesus, was eating there, she brought a beautiful alabaster jar filled with expensive perfume. Then she knelt behind him at his feet, weeping. Her tears fell on his feet. She wiped them off with her hair. Then she kept kissing his feet and putting perfume on them. When the Pharisee who invited him saw this, he said to himself, he's like, man, if this man knew, if we're a prophet, he would know the kind of woman who's touching him. She's a sinner. Then Jesus answered his thoughts. Simon, he said to Pharisee, I have something to say to you. And he goes, go ahead, teacher. I don't know if he's like, go ahead, teacher. Or he's like, go ahead, teacher. Like, you don't know if he knows. Like, he doesn't tell us, does he know he's about to get a spanking or not? We don't know. But he's like, go ahead, teacher. Then Jesus told him the story. A man loaned money to two people, 500 pieces of silver to one, 50 pieces to another. But neither of them could repay him. So he kindly forgave them both, canceling their debts. Now Jesus is talking to Simon the Pharisee. Who do you suppose loved him more after that? Funny how Simon begins to stutter and stammer. He's like, I suppose the one for whom he canceled the larger debt. I suppose, I don't know. That's right, Jesus said. Then he turned to the woman and said to Simon. By the way, catch that. He turned to the woman and said to Simon, look at this woman kneeling here. When I entered your home, you didn't offer me water to wash the dust from my feet, but she washed them with her tears and wiped them with her hair. You didn't greet me with a kiss, but from the time I first came in, she has not stopped kissing my feet. You neglected the courtesy of olive oil to anoint my head, but she has anointed my feet with rare perfume. I tell you, her sins, and they are many, have been forgiven. So she has shown me much love. But a person who is forgiven little shows only little love. Then Jesus said to the woman, by the way, his first words to her, your sins are forgiven. Now, when you first read this story, like when I was telling people I was going to speak on staff and the teaching team, like what I was telling people we're speaking on today, and everyone's like, oh, I love that story. Yeah, you like it if this isn't your dinner party. Like, can you imagine if something like this broke out at your dinner party? I mean, it's cool. It's a great story, but it is so awkward. It's like Michael Scott on The Office level of awkward, where you're just like, oh my goodness, I want to turn away, but I can't stop looking. What's happening right here? It starts out before you even realize. I mean, we see the part that we all see, the one part that's awkward, but it starts out before that being awkward. Because the way that it says that Jesus came in and immediately sat down and started eating. And later on, it points to something that's happening. You see, when we invite someone into our home today, oftentimes what happens is someone's at our door, they knock, and you go to the door, and you're like, oh, welcome, come in. You know, depending on your relationship, maybe you shake their hand, or you dap them up, or you give them a hug, or whatever, and then you welcome them into your home, and then you're like, oh, can I take your coat for you? Here, have a seat. How are things? Can I get you a cup of coffee, a glass of water? Like, this is how we greet people and invite people into our homes today. And for them, how they would do it is, in their culture, their sort of things that they would do when someone entered is someone would knock on the door, they'd be like, and they would welcome them in, and they would give them a kiss on either cheek, you know, as you've seen people do. Like, we don't do that here. I don't want to start that, but they did that then. And then what would happen is you'd give some, there'd be like water right here for them to wash their feet. And if you really honored this person, you would wash their feet for them, or have your servant, if you had one, wash their feet for them. And then you give them olive oil for their hair and their hands. It's just sort of like a way to sort of like get them ready to eat dinner with you. And so what happened here is Jesus knocks on the door, and none of those things happen. The equivalent for us would be like if someone knocked on our door, and we were like, it's open. And they're like, hello? Hey, man, glad you can make it. The chicken's gone, but we have some kale left over, and there's water in the tap, so make yourself at home. What? Oh, okay. Thank you, I think. Right? That's like, if that happened, if you guys invited someone's home, and they're like, hey, we got started without you, and dinner's all gone, but I'm glad you're here. You'd be like, wow, that is super weird and rude. I okay, thank you, I guess. Like it would just, you're not really sure if they're trying to insult you or what. That's kind of what happens here, is Jesus is invited over to this dinner party, and all of the sort of cultural rituals that you would go through, they completely blew past all of them, didn't do any of them. Then, so he lays down at this couch, and you have to understand like the situation where this happened to kind of see the picture. It's this couch called a triclinium, and it's a three-sided couch, and you lay down on it, and then all of your nicer homes in this culture at this time would have had a triclinium in like the courtyard. And houses were kind of C-shaped, in the middle was a courtyard, and then there were these couches you would lay down on, and your face would be towards the middle, and you would talk, and you would lay down, and you would eat for a very, very long time. They didn't have TV, and so they would just talk and talk and talk and talk, and you would lay down on this triclinium couch. And this courtyard is kind of like a private, kind of like a public space. And so if someone who wasn't invited to the dinner party wanted to come and hang out in the courtyard, they couldn't speak or eat or be involved, but they could listen to the conversation. So if you had leaders or religious leaders in meeting together, you could listen to the conversation and learn and grow. And so you were allowed to be in the courtyard, but you weren't allowed to be at the table. And so all of the heads kind of face the middle, and their feet kind of go out like at spokes on a wheel on this couch that you would lay down and eat at, called a triclinium. And so Jesus, he comes in, doesn't wipe his feet off, doesn't none of the stuff, and he lays down immediately on the triclinium. And so his feet are out this way, and his head is this way. And then what happens is this woman, as his feet are this way, comes up behind him, kneels down, begins to weep. And it says weep, which is a different word than like cry, which means she's kind of like ugly crying. Like, you know, when the snot is going, and they're like, it's annoying, and it's loud, and it's, so she's ugly crying at his feet now, and she's kneeling there, and she's wiping the tears off with his feet, with her hair, and she's anointing them with perfume. And Jesus doesn't look at her or acknowledge her until it says that he does. And so the whole time, like, he's on the couch having dinner, this is happening behind him, and he's not acknowledging it. But can you imagine being someone else at that dinner party then, right? Can you imagine you're like eating dinner and this is happening to someone over here and they're not looking at it, and you just be like, meanwhile, Jesus is not acknowledging it. He's like, hey, bro, that hummus looks good. Can you pass that to me? And you're like, yes. He's like, man, I love olives this time of year, don't you? Yeah. Right? Like, this is like, you love this story until you realize how awkward it is, how painfully awkward it is. Actually, so there's this oral tradition that called the Mishnah, and eventually it got written down and it's called that. And it's, so at this time, they had what we call the Old Testament, what they called the Tanakh, and then there was an oral tradition that goes with that called the Mishnah. And the Mishnah, it talks about reasons culturally for them why a man could divorce his wife, and if she cheated on him, if she was like bathing with other men, and if she let down her hair in public, which is one of the reasons the Mishnah says you could divorce. And still to this day, that their culture has a very sort of hallowed place for a woman's hair. And you see that in different cultural verses in the Bible where like it says things about hair. And so this gives you some context for when she not only had her hair down, but she was wiping her hair on his feet. Like, this would have been so awkward for everyone else at the dinner party. Just painfully, terribly awkward. I mean, yes, it's a great story. unless it happened at your house, at your dinner party that you were throwing, and then you're like, oh man, this is not what I expected. But what you have going on in this story is you have basically three main characters, and all of them have very, very different postures and approaches to what's happening here, and approaches to Jesus and how they view the other people. And the first one we're going to talk about is the woman, is this woman, this certain woman, this person, this sinner, the person who was in there and was ugly crying and wiping her hair on his feet and anointing his feet with perfume. What were her postures? What were her perspectives? What did she see? What did she believe? Why was she willing to do that? I mean, you have this dinner party with these important people all coming together, and here she is. She's not invited. She's not allowed to interact or interrupt at all, and she's completely going against sort of cultural norms and what's expected of her. She's making a fool of herself. Why would she do that? I mean, she already is a castaway. You know, she's an outcast in society. Why would she dig the hole even deeper in this situation? You have to ask, what did she know? See, what did she know that other people didn't know? What did she know that Simon, the Pharisee who invited Jesus, didn't know? Why was she willing to make a fool of herself? It reminds me of a movie. You ever seen like a Godzilla movie or something, when like the main character, like Godzilla's coming towards the town, and somewhere in some bunker you see like people looking at a radar and it's going around, and like the Godzilla figure is like moving towards the town slowly, and our hero generally knows what's coming, and so you see him and he's like running away from what Godzilla's coming towards town, and like you have other people, and so this person knows Godzilla's coming and they're gonna run away from where Godzilla's coming, and you have, you know, in the city, wherever Godzilla's about to come and crash, there's always like a businessman on a very important business phone call, a very important business suit, holding his very important business briefcase. And he's like walking, and our character is like running away from whatever's coming, like a zombies or Godzilla or whatever's coming this way. And he knows something that this person doesn't know. And he's going to run through town like a crazy person, panicked, away from the danger that's imminent. There's always like the businessman who's like, hey, yeah, so stocks and bonds and hedge funds and blah, blah, blah. And they're running away. And he sees the person run by and just keeps going and doesn't think twice about it. And then like what happens next? Like Godzilla's foot comes out and squashes the businessman because he didn't know what this person knew. But the person running through town making a fool of themselves, he knows something that other people didn't know. Like he knows, and he is dealing with, and he is responding to what he knows differently than what everyone else is responding to. He's willing to make a fool of himself in a way that others are not, based on what he knows. And so what does this woman know? What does she know that other people don't know? You know, Simon invited Jesus to his house, this Pharisee. So he must have heard of Jesus. He must have heard the things Jesus taught about. Must have heard the things that Jesus had done, the miracles he'd performed. And he was coming and he wanted to experience Jesus firsthand. And so it's not like Simon didn't know Jesus. I imagine Simon knew just as much about Jesus as this woman did. So then what is it that she knew? Why is it she was willing to make a fool of herself? And the only one at this dinner party willing to make a fool of herself in this way. It wasn't something about Jesus. Other people knew about Jesus. Then it must have been something she knew about herself. Right? So what could she have known? She probably knew her own brokenness. She probably knew her need for Jesus. She was probably the only one at this dinner party who knew how much she needed Jesus. She needed to be forgiven. She needed to be shaped. She needed to be invited. She needed to be given grace to. She needed to be challenged. She was probably the only person at this party. The one thing that she knew, the thing that caused her to act out from the place of what she knew, is that she knew she was in touch with her need for Jesus. She couldn't fake it. She couldn't act like it was all good. She couldn't act like she had her stuff together. She couldn't go there. She was so painfully in touch with her need for Jesus. For her to make a fool of herself in this way at the dinner is because she knew she needed him in a way that Simon clearly didn't. You know, Simon the Pharisee, you know, that's her posture. That's what she's bringing to the dinner party. I think the other thing that she knew, by the way, like the first thing she knew is that she needed Jesus. Second thing she knew for her, perfume would have been very central to having a successful business, because this is someone who was probably a prostitute. And so for her to have perfume, this would have been very, very important for her running a successful business in her trade. And so for her to pour the perfume out onto Jesus' feet, meant that she couldn't use that perfume for her business anymore, which means that she was probably walking away from her. She was never going to go back to that life again. That she was going, whatever had happened, whatever Jesus had said, whatever grace and forgiveness she had experienced for the first time there, when she had gotten, when she become like in touch with her need for Jesus, at the same time, she was going to pour this perfume out. She's going to burn her ship, so to speak. She's not going back. She's not going back to that life. She's going to invest all, like, I'm not going back. That whatever you said, you've set me free. I am not going back to that life. I'm going to pour my perfume out onto your feet because I don't need it anymore. I'm not going back to that life. So she knew that she needed Jesus, and she knew that Jesus had set her free. And so she's going to be willing to make a fool of herself in that way. But Simon, see, she was confident that she knew who she was, and she was confident and she knew who Jesus was, and Simon and what he wanted was completely irrelevant to this situation. But Simon was also confident. Simon was confident about Simon, and Simon was confident about the woman. He knew who he was, and he had a pretty good idea in his mind of who she was. He had her sort of like a context for her, but he doubted Jesus. He didn't know who Jesus was. He's trying to figure out this whole Jesus thing. And then in verse 39, it kind of reveals what he thinks about himself and her and Jesus. In 39, it says this: when the Pharisee who had invited him, Jesus, saw this, the way she was acting, he said to himself, "If this man were a prophet, he would know what kind of woman is touching him, for she is a sinner." Now, this idea of sinner, this would have been someone who lived with a lifestyle of brokenness, who lived with a lifestyle that was obvious to everyone, oppositional to who God had made this person to be. Like, this is someone who would have lived with a reputation, and their reputation preceded them. And this could have been assigned to men or women, but oftentimes they're assigned to women in the Bible. It's because of they were the same vocation as her. And so he says, man, Jesus must not be a prophet, because if he really was a prophet, he would know what kind of person is touching him. She's a sinner. Now think about this term, and any term that creates categories of in and out and better than and worse than, is that it inherently, like, what we oftentimes we do this, and we do it when we can present ourselves as the better than category, when we know that we're on the good end of the spectrum and this person on the bad end of the spectrum. And this category, this idea of, oh, that, you know, that person, they're a sinner. I mean, yeah, I've sinned, but like mine are like, you know, small ones. But that person, no, they got big ones in their life. They have huge sins, you know, like, yeah, so I screamed at my wife. No one saw it. I'm good. But that person, they are a sinner. Like, that, what you're doing is you're putting, like, creating this spectrum of good, not as good, bad, very bad, sinner. Like, that's them down there. And when we, in church world, we know that we shouldn't do this. Like, when we get tempted to, like, categorize people this way, like, our spider sense goes off. We're like, oh, I'm a church person, so I shouldn't do this. I shouldn't categorize people. But we do it sneaky. You know, we're like, oh, I haven't seen you in church in a while. Why is that? Sinner, you know, the little, you know. Oh, well, you know what? Did you know that at church, how involved I am? Did you know that? Yeah, I do the front door and the back door and the kids department, and I set out the crackers, and I greet people, and I'm always smiling. And when I see you come, sometimes you cry and stuff, which lets me know that you got a lot going on. And, I heard that you say naughty words too still, which is cute, but I smell better than you, so I'm better than you. Like, we don't actually say these things, but, you know, there are things that come through that we're you're that. I'm sorry. That's cute, but you know. And we have these categories of in and out and how involved and not involved. And what, you know what this is? Honestly, what this is? Like, for him to say, doesn't he know she's a sinner? He's saying, doesn't he know how broken she is? She doesn't make the cut. She shouldn't be here. He shouldn't interact with her. She's too broken. But the flip side of that is, I'm not. Like, Simon's saying, I'm not broken. I don't need you as bad as she does. She needs you more than me. I don't have as many sins as her. Like, I'm not as bad off as her. I'm not. Anytime you say that person is that, you're saying I am the opposite. And so what you're saying is, what he was saying is, I don't need Jesus. I don't need you. I don't have a need for you. I'm not broken like she is. Like, she's clearly very broken, and if he knew how broken she was, he wouldn't be allowing this. I'm not that broken. Like, you're in my house. You're laying on my couch. Like, I have my stuff together. And so this, his whole perspective, he's so confident in himself. He's so confident that he has his stuff together. And so Jesus responds to him. Jesus' posture, spiritual, interpersonal, literal posture, responds to them. And it responds to both of these people. And what's fascinating and beautiful and profound about what Jesus does is he responds to both people, not where he wants them to be, but exactly where they are in that moment. See, Jesus, he says, Simon, I want to ask you a question. And then he tells them this very, very short, one of the shortest parables in the Bible. And he says, if there's two people, this person's been given 500, this person's been forgiven 50. Who loves the person who forgave them more? It's a very, very simple one. And Simon's like, well, I suppose, I guess, the one who was forgiven the most. And Jesus says, you have judged rightly. Now, what Jesus is doing is talking about these two people. Simon, been forgiven 50. The woman, been forgiven 500. He's posing this question to Simon. However, Simon the Pharisee hadn't been forgiven the 50. But that's what Simon thought about himself. See, Jesus is meeting him exactly where he's at. He's not meeting him exactly what he needs in this moment. He's meeting him exactly where he's at. He's like, you think you're better than this person. So let me frame this in terms of, you think you're better. All right, let me meet you exactly where you're at. You think you're better. All right, let's say there's someone who's given 50 and this person forgiven 500. He frames this whole situation in terms of not where they are, but where they think they are. And Jesus meets both people in exactly that place. He meets her. And he meets him where he thinks he is. And after he tells the story, he continues to speak to Simon, but he looks at her. He says it in verse 44. It says this. Then he, Jesus, turned to the woman and said to Simon, look at this woman kneeling here. So what you have is he's talking to Simon about Simon's stuff and Simon's pride and the veneer of religiosity that he puts on. And then he turns to her and he continues to speak to Simon. He's like, look at this woman kneeling here. And actually in the original language, it's not just like aim your eyes at her, but it's like actually see her. Like, acknowledge her, see what she's gone through, engage with her on another level. He's like, Simon, do you even see her? Do you see her? Do you see the things she's gone through? Do you see the way she's not where she wants to be? Do you see the way that she acknowledges her own brokenness, her own need for me? Do you see the way that no one ends up in this place unless things have broken wrong for them over and over, the way that she's been abused and neglected and abandoned? Do you see her? He's like, Simon, do you even see her? You don't see her. You don't see the journey she's on. You don't see what she's gone through. You don't see the way she's hurting, the way she now feels freedom and pride and dignity for the first time. Do you see any of this? How can you not see this, Simon? And he says in verse 47 and 48, he keeps going. He says this. I tell you, her sins, and they are many, have been forgiven. So she has shown me much love. He's still talking to him, looking at her. She has shown me much love. He keeps going. He says this. He says, but a person who is forgiven little shows only little love. He's still talking to Simon in terms of what Simon believes is true of Simon, not what is true of him, because Jesus always meets you exactly where you are. Then Jesus said to the woman, your sins are forgiven. This is the first time he speaks to her. He's looking at her, and now he's finally speaking to her. He says, your sins are forgiven. You know, and we, the church and things of faith, we've talked, you know, if you spend any time in church, you've probably heard this word sin before. And if you spend a lot of time in church, maybe you've heard that the word sin comes from this archery term, which means missing the mark. And it's this word, hamartia. And this is the root word. And it's like if you try and shoot an arrow at a target and you don't quite hit the bullseye, then you've hamartia, you've missed the mark. And this word sin comes from archery. Also, archery, super hard. Like they do that in the Olympics. It's incredibly hard. Like we were at a meeting one time, John, Emery, and I, and we were in a meeting and we saw an archery set out the window and we're like, excuse us, we're going to go shoot arrows for a few minutes because this meeting's long. And so we went out and we were shooting arrows, and this is the very true story. And so we're shooting arrows and I'm like this, and I let go and it like goes this direction for some reason. I don't know why, you know, I think I hit a squirrel or something, but like, So very, very difficult to hit the mark, like very, very difficult. And you're like, man, like that seems, like that's, I guess that makes sense. Sin is hitting, missing the mark, but that's still like super hard. And who defined that as the mark? And actually, if you go even further back in the history of this word, this hamartia, actually this word hamartia, which we get our root sin from, it was a literary term before it was a religious or faith-based term. And a hamartia was the main character's, something about the main character that prevented them from having the best possible outcome in the story. So the best example would be Achilles. His heel was his hamartia. That was his point of weakness. And that was what caused his outcome to not be the best possible. In Romeo and Juliet, their love isn't their hamartia, but it's their inability to see the long term. They're kind of short-sighted in the story, and that is their hamartia. It's not this, it didn't start out this thing that's inherently moral or ethical or bad and good. It started out with something that is true about someone or something that, and their hamartia prevents them from living their best possible destiny or outcome or purpose or mission for life. Like it's any step out away from, not in the direction that they were created for. And so as you look at sin, what it actually is, what it's always been, is it has always been, before it was missing the mark, before it was sort of like had all these things and guilt and shame hung on to it, it was anything originally, anything, any step in any direction, not the direction you were designed for. Not the direction God created you for. God created you on purpose, with meaning, and with something he wanted you to do and accomplish with your life. He created you with gifts, and he says, go and use these gifts and change the world in my name. And he has the best possible. And so sin, originally, was any step away from that exact trajectory for your life. So you look at these two people Jesus is talking to. Someone who thinks they have very little sin and someone who knows, who's very, very in touch with how destructive their life has become. And he says, yes, she has sinned, and her sins, they are many. He says, she has stepped away from who I've designed her to be. Like, I love her, and I want her to live this productive life and use her gifts and live with purpose and meaning and hope and beauty. And I want that for her. And almost her entire life, she's been running in the opposite direction. Do you even see that? Do you see that, Simon? This is what this is happening here. Yes, she has sinned, and her sins are many, but they are forgiven. But do you see, guys, that what this also means for him? You see, he has put this veneer on his life of like, this is who I am, and I'm going to put this forward. And every step along the way of like this sort of prideful veneer life is a step away from who God designed him to be. The way that God purposed him and gifted him and has called him and wants him to live with that purpose and wants to live with meaning and beauty and freedom and life to the full. And it's a step away from that. And so he says, you know what? He doesn't think there aren't going to be consequences in her life. She's going to have to live with consequences, and that's just part of life. But he says, your sins, the steps you've gone in the wrong direction, we're wiping that clean. That no longer defines you. You are forgiven. So what do we do with this? Man, I guess two things I would say. Live with clarity. Like sometimes in life, I know in my life I've had moments of clarity, moments where I experience clarity and I see myself and with crystal clear, and I see my need for Jesus, and I see the way that I am broken, and I see the way that I need Jesus desperately today. I am far more like the woman than I am the Pharisee. Like there are moments in my life when I see my life and I see the clarity, my life and how much I desperately need Jesus today. You know, Harbor of Hope exists to help people find their way back to God, because everyone needs God to help them and shape them and mold them at all times. And so live with clarity, live with honesty. I said it before, that Jesus, he interacts with us to the depth at which we are honest. And so if we are honest with him, if we're honest with our brokenness, if we live with clarity, he will come alongside and he will shape and he will mold and he will challenge and he will invite to that same depth. So the first challenge is to live with clarity. Live honest about your brokenness and yours and mine and yours and yours and mine and yours. And did I say mine yet? Like, live palpably with my brokenness. Not because that woe is me or that defines me, because the more broken I am, the more honest I am, the more grateful I am, the more defined by him I am, the more unshakable I am. You can't tell me I'm broken. I already know I'm broken, but I'm defined by Jesus, so he sets me free. Live with this sense of clarity about your own brokenness. The second thing I would say is, when we view other people, to see people not as defined by their past, or like, oh, you're here and I'm here, or like, you're clearly you're busted, but to see people the way that Jesus called Simon to see her. Like, when someone comes in and they're broken down and they're hurting and they're at rock bottom, do you see them? Do I see them? Do I get too busy? Do I see them for their flaws? Or do I actually see them the way that Jesus calls us to? Not as someone defined by that, but as someone who their hamartia, the thing that God has designed them for a purpose and designed them to accomplish and to move and be set free, and they've taken steps in other directions, and it's our job to encourage them and to love them back onto the right path. That is our job, not to judge, not to look down. You know what happens when someone lives with another perspective on sin, or they live with a veneer long enough? People get opinionated and mean, don't they? If you live with a veneer long enough, if you live with this sort of like acting like you have your stuff all together, you become hateful people. And so really the invitation here is twofold. Live with clarity about your own brokenness. I want to live with clarity about my brokenness, because the more honest I am with Jesus, the more he is free to mold me and change me and shape me. And as I view people, as I look at people, do I honestly see people the way that Jesus does? Or do I see someone and categorize them? I believe that if we do these things in the community, if we are honest about our brokenness, and when we see someone's brokenness, we invite them into the journey, not push them away. What it does is it creates a platform for us to live with authentic community with one another, acknowledging each other's brokenness. You're broken, you're broken, you're broken, I'm broken, I'm broken. Great, we're all broken. Now that we know what's honest in there, we can go forward and do life together. And also we can be an environment where people can come in, they can share their brokenness and find hope and healing and purpose and meaning and get back on the path. Like, this is so foundational to what it means to be a church marked by Jesus. So my prayer for us is that we live these two things, that we live with clarity on our need for Jesus, and we don't allow people to be defined by their past, that we encourage them to take steps towards Jesus regardless of where they are, where we meet them like Jesus exactly where they are today and invite them to walk with him. Won't you pray with me? Jesus, I'm so thankful for this story, because it's my story. You met me in my brokenness. You met me in my selfishness. You met me in my inability to save myself, my inability to change myself. And so this is I love this story because it's my story. God, I stand before you and before these people and say to you and to these people that I desperately need you. I am broken. I am flawed. I am selfish. I get angry. I fight for my own. I yell at my kids. I get mad at unreasonably mad at my wife. Like, I am broken. I am flawed. And I desperately need you. And God, let this be true of all of us. Let this be true of every single person who calls Harbor home, that we are so in touch with our brokenness, so in touch with our flaws, that we are just constantly like, yes, worshiping you like this woman did. We know something that other people don't know, which is our own brokenness. Yes, I will be a fool. Yes, I'll be more undignified than this, because you have come in and you've set me free. So God, let this be true of us as a community. And once we are in touch with our own brokenness, then other people can come in and not feel like they have to put a veneer up, but they can come up and be honestly shaped and honestly molded and honestly changed, because we don't have to put up a front. So people can come in and meet you in authentic and beautiful ways and be set free. So we love you. Thank you for the way that you meet us how we are. And you invite yourselves into our lives and give us the strength to be honest about our own brokenness. And give us the ability to see people the way you do, not for their flaws, but for the journey that you designed them for. Yes, they have sin, but that's just getting in the way of who you've called them to be long ago, who you created them to be long before they were even born. But God, we love you and we thank you for the way that you sent your son. And he calls us to embrace our brokenness and to love other people because of theirs. In your name, amen.